You're listening to the Founder Coach Podcast, a show that investigates what it really means to be the CEO of a fast-growing tech company. My name's Dave Bailey, and I coach founders that raise capital from the world's top venture funds to fuel their business. And I'm sitting down with CEOs to talk about their experiences, the challenges they face, and the lessons they've learned, or are learning right now. Hello, founders and friends. Today, we're speaking with the CEO of VenueScanner, which is a platform to help event organizers find their ideal venue and local businesses rent out extra space. This CEO, as well as being a Forbes 30 under 30, she's also a very good friend. Rebecca Kelly, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you, Dave. Delighted to be here.
I haven't seen you in a while. How have you been?
It's been a journey for the last year, but I've been good. I'm very well and I feel optimistic about the future, even though we're in the third lockdown we're in now?
Oh my Lord. Well, if we were speaking a year ago, we would be talking about some unprecedented success. And I thought we would start there before talking about COVID, which obviously has had a big impact in the events industry.
That's nice. Start with a positive.
Absolutely. So do you want to talk us through where VenueScanner came from?
Yeah, I was working at M&S in digital marketing and e-commerce and always looking for venues for our team offsites and Christmas parties, and just had a really, really painful experience trying to find and book space. You're kind of like calling loads of venues, writing notes down. The only ones that you know about off the top of your head are really expensive, and we're surrounded by all this amazing space, especially in London, with really cool warehouses and church and empty schools. So really started thinking about how do we bring to market more of these spaces, as well as really improve the experience for people trying to discover and book space online. So that was kind of 2016, set out with the mission of creating a marketplace platform where it's really, really easy to find and book space. So as any other marketplace founder will tell you, building a marketplace is not quite as fast as you think it's going to be when you first set out.
What did you think it was going to be like?
I thought, you know, in 3 months, we'll build a website, we'll get it live, customers are going to start using it, we'll turn on some ads, we'll be making 10 million a year. In 2 years, I think that was my plan.
Is that all?
So it didn't quite happen as fast as that. Lots of learning at the beginning on the supply side. So how do we get venues to join the platform, and built quite a automated way of doing that, which helped us to become the largest marketplace for supply quite quickly within 6 months. So we had ranges of every different type of venue you could imagine, 10,000 across the UK in different cities, and then started building the demand side after that, finding event organizers that needed the platform and working on SEO and Google rankings to get customers using it. It took us over a year and a couple of funding rounds to get to the place where the marketplace started ticking and we started seeing good traction. So we had about 8 months where we were growing 50 to 60% month on month till March 2019 when COVID hit. Built the team up to, we were 34 people in March and operating all across the UK and just starting to do some international testing.
To get to 60% month on month is amazing. What were some of the assumptions about the demand side that turned out to be false?
So we assumed at the beginning that it would be quite easy to connect with businesses wanting to book events. One of the big blockers that we found early on was knowing the right person within a company to speak to. We thought, okay, we'll focus in on personal assistants and exec assistants, which is a great market for us. We have a really strong customer group there, but actually people at every different level and job title will book a venue within a company. So it could be the CEO, it could be an assistant, it could be an intern, it could be a marketing manager. That variation of job roles makes speaking to those customers and identifying them more challenging.
I wanted to ask about business model, because there's a lot of different ways you can run a marketplace. How does it work in the event space?
So that's a great question. And one of our initial assumptions, which was totally wrong. So our initial assumption was that people want to find and book a venue online, but there just wasn't a platform that enabled them to do that. So we built the marketplace so that you could find a venue and you could inquire and book and pay online. But what we discovered was that specifically for larger events, people don't really want to book online in that way straight away. The way that venues communicate information is quite nuanced. So some will want to attach a PDF, some will want to do a video tour, some will actually go for a real tour. So we evolved the product a lot over time for enabling the interactions between venues and organizers, and started moving much more towards a, like an Airbnb chat function, but not like Airbnb because it was a range of viewing and ad attachments. So that messaging part became bigger. What then happened was that our business model was commission-based. So you make a booking, we take a cut of the booking, which in a transactional marketplace makes complete sense because it means there's no blocker to acquiring supply. It's all incremental for them. And the problem that we had was that most of our bookings, 80%, were going offline. People would inquire with a venue and then they would book directly. Not because they were trying to cut us out necessarily on either side at all, more just because that's the way that people traditionally do that. We ended up building quite a large team of people who were effectively trying to figure out, have these bookings happened? How do we improve the booking process and the product? What a customer success team should be doing is helping the venue or the organizer to reach their goal. And really, it felt like we were kind of looking back on an event to try and understand if it happened or not. And then we decided to switch that business model and move to a subscription model. We tested it in late 2018. And then spring, summer 2019, fully launched that subscription model. And that's when we really saw the growth take off much more substantially. It felt like a much better fit for the way that people were using the platform and the way that we worked with our venues.
What's the insight about supply in a marketplace that would tell you whether that marketplace is best served by commission or by subscription?
So one thing about subscription with marketplaces is you've got to be incredibly data-led and accurate on matching the demand and supply. If I'm a supplier on a subscription model and it's based on demand, I need to be getting a continued flow of demand monthly, quarterly, weekly, daily to continue to subscribe. There are a lot of subscription kind of versions where it's sort of a SaaS-based marketplace. If you can serve the supply with a beneficial software that's outside of driving demand. So for example, we're looking at giving venues their own kind of marketing suite so they can do their own marketing, both via VenueScanner, but also via other platforms as well. Whereas if it's purely demand-based, you've got to have the high volume and frequency of demand that the supply needs to make it positive return on investment for them.
You said the team grew to 34 people pre-COVID. What was it like to grow the team?
I think some of the biggest lessons you learn as a first-time founder and CEO is around hiring and growing the team. The thing that I always used to think is, oh, if only I had someone to do that part of the role, or if only I had an extra person there, and then you have extra people and then you just have totally different challenges. So, but one of the things that was really challenging is getting that balance of how senior do you hire, how early on. It's something that I think it's quite prevalent in startups, is knowing when to hire people who have done it before or know what they're doing, and when to hire people who are hungry and they want to grow and want to do it. And I veered to the hiring people who are hungry, have the right aptitude and energy and passion to deliver what they want to do, and then growing those people into the roles.
What do you learn about senior candidates for roles in a startup?
So the way that we traditionally look at recruitment was, okay, we need a COO, or we need a CTO, or we need more revenue, so we want to hire a salesperson. And it's quite straightforward. This is a job title and hire in. This year of COVID gave me a lot of time to reflect on really how I would do things differently and really pushing myself to think differently about it. I hadn't necessarily identified what's the thing that needs to change in the business over the next 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. There's probably not that much point from the stage that we were at, looking that much further than 12 months in terms of what we actually want someone to achieve.
One thing that I found was that senior managers are often used to managing teams. And in a startup, yes, there's no one to manage.
Yes, exactly. I think that team management part is critical once you do have the team to manage, and you need that management expertise. Often in large companies, the focus, it's a lot around communication and a lot around process, which are both very important. But when you're in early stages of a startup, it's almost the total reverse, where the communication's often quite good because you're a small team and you're in the same place. Actually, what you need to deliver is the most important thing. Like, what needs to happen today, tomorrow, next week, next month. And it's very hard, I think, to adjust that mindset if you've been very used to being in large companies. I've had one experience. I would almost describe it as like a reverse magnet. Nothing personal. It's just that the fit in this scenario wasn't right at all. It's my job and our job in interview processes to set expectations around stage of company, like exactly what to expect coming in. And I think when you're bringing people in from much larger companies, managing that expectation and managing the founder tendency to sell the dream, which you're always doing, to also communicating the reality of the ways of working is an important balance to get right.
And it's tricky, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you want to sell the big vision to the candidate. And there's probably some tension there when you're talking about the parts of the role that are underdeveloped, or when you're at an early stage, there's a lot of skeletons in the closet that could feel uncomfortable to reveal.
Yeah, totally. I think just the amount of grind that you've got to do to get to that scaling up stage is sometimes the part that's underestimated, I think.
Yeah. Now, I know that you brought on a chief of staff during that journey. I'm curious to learn more about that. When did you decide to bring on a chief of staff, and what do they do?
One of the better decisions I've made. She's been a savior for the company. It was probably 2 years ago that we brought her on. We decided to bring in the chief of staff role because there were a lot of areas that didn't necessarily fall into a very clear spec. It wasn't sales, it wasn't operations, it wasn't finance. There were kind of a lot of different areas across the business that we felt like were slipping away and not being handled, but were really important. And then there was one of the core things was actually around recruitment and culture. So that was probably the most fundamental part to start with. I sort of calculated out how much it cost us to hire and grow, how we needed to using recruitment companies to support. And actually it was the same to hire somebody full-time in the company who could support with that and also across some of the other areas. So the role was really around helping to build the team, manage and maintain the culture and the kind of core communication between the teams. And it evolved hugely. She's helped all of the recruitment around building the team from, I think, 7 to 34 was about the stage. And we sort of more clearly defined all of our values and then really like operationalized parts of the culture more. So, for example, we have a channel on Slack called the Values Hustle channel, where people would post examples of when someone had done something great or within the values and keeping the momentum live. And then she ended up doing a lot around communications across the business. So like anytime there was a meeting, that was written up and sent round, the strategy and documentation's clear, which often gets lost once the team starts getting bigger. So really just like bridging the gaps and making sure that everyone was on the same page and goals were aligned, setting up OKRs about 18 months ago, which made quite a big difference to the operational side of the business as well.
And what was it like for you to bring on a chief of staff?
Yeah, it was amazingly helpful for me. A lot of their role is to support you holistically rather than in a specific role. Took a lot of weight off my shoulders, and almost I had somebody to soundboard decisions off, have a gauge of how the team was feeling, where we had resource gaps. I think often I felt like I wasn't always fully aware of exactly what needed to be done where, and she really like bridged that gap between what was going on in the team. Yeah, it was a huge support and helped me sleep at night better.
Yeah. What are the key qualities that make for a good chief of staff?
I think the relationship with the CEO is really the most critical thing. There's got to be a very high level of trust. So I implicitly trust my chief of staff, and that's definitely the thing that makes the role most successful from my perspective. Being organized, being very open in communication, that you know that they'll candidly tell you whatever needs to be said with no barriers, which no one else in the company might do. And being able to build the relationships with the rest of the team at the right level as well. So they also need to implicitly trust her or him to be able to have that information flow across the business. And then in terms of actual hard skills and background, I think it really varies. I mean, I've spoken to people who have got chief of staffs who are from blue chip consultancies who are like amazing at spreadsheets and pitch decks, et cetera. And then some people who have come out of recruitment, HR, and some people who have come into the company as an intern or out of university and developed into that role. So it depends on where your weaknesses are as a CEO and where you need someone to help or support, I think.
And where did your chief of staff come from?
She'd done recruitment and HR for a number of years. So that was definitely important because the first thing that I wanted her to help on was the recruitment side, and she knew how to do that. And then she'd actually been working in finance for asset managers, and then she operated the whole of the rest of the business, which was actually great for us because she was the one generalist who would do everything else across the whole business. So that was somebody who had that kind of experience of pulling all the other bits of the business together. That experience has been important for her in the role.
And you mentioned trust, and that a key success factor is that there's a lot of trust between the chief of staff and the CEO. How do you go about building trust, particularly if you don't know them before? Did you know your chief of staff before?
Yeah, I did know her before. So that trust part was there before. But I think, you know, I now have a similar level of trust with other people who report into me in the company now, where we've now worked together for kind of 2 years or so. And for me, it does take 18 months plus, I think, to really understand each other and know each other and have that level of trust. The things that can fast track that, I guess, is I think knowing each other personally is really important. In our team days, once a year at least, I always make sure to invite everyone's other halves to the event so that we can know people's whole life rather than just work life. So being able to relate on a personal level as well, and just taking it outside of work. At the moment, I'm doing walking one-to-ones because that's all we're permitted to do. But it's great because, you know, as you know, we've done walks before. You speak and think in a different way when you're walking. It releases anxiety and you're in a different environment. And so I think getting out into different environments, whether it's going for a walk, having dinner at home, sometimes I like to invite the leadership team and other halves for dinner at home to make that environment more personal. Giving open and candid feedback is, of course, an important one as well. If you know that you can openly challenge and feedback to each other, it's always hard receiving and giving feedback, but it's just such an important part of merging as a team, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And having been to one of your team events, I just remember there being such a warm and friendly atmosphere. And I don't think that you can do that unless you build those personal connections. So I love that you said that all of the team invite their other halves. When there's a trust crisis, it's not always the first thing you think about, which is the personal connection. And yet it's such a big deal.
Totally. At the beginning of COVID and this year, I'm so grateful for everyone, even the people that we've so sadly had to let go of. I'm so grateful for all of them and the way that everyone communicated and supported each other, and the understanding was immense. And I think that it can't exist unless you've got the personal trust and friendship, at least mutual respect for each other.
100%. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get to the meat and potatoes. We're going to talk about COVID and events and what happened in the last year. So stay tuned. Alex, thanks so much for jumping on the call. You are the CEO of StepSize. In a sentence, what does StepSize do?
StepSize is an issue tracker that lives in the code editor and helps engineering teams fight technical debt.
Now, you recently took the Clarity program. What motivated you to take Clarity?
Well, I'd collected loads of user feedback on our product and positioning and was a few months away from starting to fundraise again. And I wanted to take all our lessons and integrate them into a new narrative for StepSize, the company, but also the product.
Got it. Now, could you share some of your key takeaways from doing the program?
I loved working with storytelling templates. Having every aspect of StepSize written down into a short paragraph with clear sections to tweak for every iteration was hugely helpful in clarifying my thinking. On top of that, it was extremely helpful to bounce ideas and run our work past the community of founders who were also working through the program. I can't tell you how many great ideas I picked up from them.
And is there anything you want people who are considering Clarity to know?
Just do it. As a founder, I would recommend Clarity to any startup founder and CEO looking for a framework that they can use to clarify and constantly improve their company's narrative over its lifetime. My cohort included founders at very different company stages, and they all left with major breakthroughs.
That is awesome. Thank you so much, Alex. If you want to learn about how StepSize can help you with your tech debt, why don't you visit stepsize.com? And if you want to learn about what Clarity can do for your company, visit davebailey.com, click the link to the Clarity, and get in touch. I would love to hear from you. Now let's get back to this amazing episode. Welcome back. It's pretty early in the morning. Are you a morning person or an evening person?
Yeah, annoyingly, I'm like morning and evening, not afternoon. We're kind of up at 6 and then I try and work 7:30 till 9:30. It's like my dream work hours, which is like get stuff done. 3 till 5 is the real dead zone.
Interesting.
What about you?
I hate mornings. I really hate mornings and I love evenings. So last week I took a week to do some writing and all my best writing is done literally between midnight and 4 a.m.
That's amazing.
And it's just quiet and everyone's sleeping and I'm just batting away at my computer, getting clarity in my own head. I can definitely relate to that 3 p.m. dip, which actually changed a bit for me when I went zero carb. You can tell my energy levels based on what I'm having for lunch. And so when I changed what I had for lunch, it helped a little bit. Have you found that?
Yeah, I think it definitely helps. It's one of the benefits of lockdown. Actually, I really enjoy being able to control my food because otherwise at the office, I'll just run to prep and grab a sandwich. Whereas here, I'd never have a sandwich for lunch. I have like tomato, avocado and hummus and stuff like that. Healthy stuff.
Yeah.
But in the office, I just wouldn't because it's like, I'm just trying to get through the day. You just grab something quickly and this different mindset.
Yeah, totally. So I'd like to go back to the beginning of COVID. So this would be around sort of February last year, I guess, about a year ago. What do you remember about that time?
So we had this amazing team night out with everyone. We went to this underground club with live music and we were celebrating the volume of inquiries on the platform, which was a milestone we'd had for a while and, you know, some great growth. And we were sitting around a table, like having drinks, having a great time. And COVID, it was very early in the news. Maybe it was the end of Feb, very beginning of March. And it wasn't something that anyone had taken seriously at all. And within 24 hours, I kind of called everyone into the office. It was the day after. I was like, guys, I want you all to work from home. And everyone almost laughed at me. Why do we need to work from home? It's just the media. It's ridiculous. And I was like, guys, I want you to be safe. Let's just stay at home and just work remotely just for a couple of weeks. We know how to do it because we have work from home Wednesdays. And I remember sitting in the corner of my bedroom on the floor, going through the news. I think this was the 9th or 10th of March. And I was like, this is not looking good. And I wrote for about 2 hours this whole plan, which had 3 models of like doomsday scenario where our revenue would drop over 50% and it would last for 4 whole months. That was doomsday. And then there were 2 better scenarios than that. And I wrote an email to the board saying, we need an emergency board meeting tomorrow to discuss this COVID situation. I don't think it's going to be good and we want to be ahead of it. So this was maybe a week before the lockdown. So I called them. One of my board members is in travel, heavily in Asia. So he was ahead of the game on it. And he was like, Rebecca, it's very bad. You're right. You know, we've got to do something. Anyway, so regardless of the scenario, we figured out that I had to let go of 20 people in the team out of 34. That was like the bad scenario. And I wasn't sure if that was the right thing. And then we had the lockdown news. And my mum was in South Africa. So we went out to her house in Oxford to stay there and thought, oh, we'll stay here for a week. 4 months later, we were still there. Our flat lease was up at that time as well. So yeah, I was in the kitchen and then had to do the full call to the whole team to share the situation and where we were and follow on with the redundancies and everything that came from that, which was, you know, I think you asked how it felt. I remember feeling this sort of huge sense of pace of needing to act that I don't even know really where it came from, but I was like, we've got to make really hard decisions now or we're going to be in trouble. I felt the real need to kind of make sure we were doing stuff early. I knew it would be about cash management and not about raising more money. That was one of the harder decisions later on, I think, was getting that balance. But yeah, letting the team go and that the first round of redundancies, of which unfortunately, we ended up having to do 2 in the second lockdown, but it was just really sad. It was very emotional. Everyone was so, so supportive. I think just grateful for the open communication. Yeah, it was very heartbreaking to have to do that. And the point that drove that trigger was that we saw a 95% drop in all of our metrics the minute the lockdown hit. So obviously with venues closing and events not happening, we were like very at the forefront of the impact of that. And even in my doomsday scenario, which was down 60%, that was not forecasted for. And it stayed there until things started to pick back up in the summertime.
Oh, my word. So almost overnight, it goes down to effectively zero. How much did you cut the team?
So we cut the team from 34 down to 12.
Mm-hmm.
Then soon after that, they introduced the furlough scheme. So then we had five of us working and everyone else was on furlough.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked with the product team and a couple of our custom service team. And we spent the time focusing on drilling into the data that we had. As hard and horrific as that drop was, it's very rare that you get the opportunity as a startup to really take stock of the last few years, everything you've done, what's worked, what's not worked, really drill into the data, really speak to customers. And, you know, lots of our venues and customers, they were very keen to talk and touch base. We started a Slack group called Hospitality Heroes and invited everyone to join in the community, and people exchanged, you know, what they were doing, venues, kind of how they were pivoting, offering takeaways, it was at that point, or clarifying the rules, which were very grey at the beginning. And we just spent time working on the product, improving it to put the business into a better place when we hoped that it would come back, which was in our minds summertime, like July, August.
2020 vision, you know, this is kind of a multi-year pandemic. But at the beginning, there was so much uncertainty. How did you manage the self-doubt and how did the team manage?
The biggest thing that I've learned this year is how to create certainty in extreme uncertainty. And I never thought that certainty was something that was necessarily important in a startup, but it became so obvious to me so quickly that what the team needed and what our venues and customers needed was some sense of certainty where they weren't getting certainty from anywhere else. So how we did that, there's a model of control that's like circles of influence, and the outside circles are the areas where you don't have any influence or control over them. And you have to go deeper and deeper into the things that you can really influence and control. And I think what we saw in COVID, especially for CEOs and especially in our industry, is that the area that you cannot influence became huge relative to where it was before, because that external impact was so significant on consumer sentiment, on physically what venues were and weren't allowed to do.
What were the things that you could control in your business?
The things that we could control were how we communicated with customers, all of our internal communications was totally in our control. So at the beginning, it was not helping on cancellations or refunds, helping venues with what kind of policies would be good to put in place to enable organizers to book without concern later in the year. There was things around product development, and then there were operational areas where, because we did that really quick growth for the prior 8 months, lots of things when you grow that fast fall through the cracks. So things like operational finance was an area that needed some attention. And so we've sort of set things up so that when we go back to that, it will be much quicker and easier in the way that we onboard customers and the way that subscription works.
You spoke with your investors about this early. And when I spoke with them, they said one of the things that they were most impressed with was your honesty and how you were completely transparent with them. What does it take to build good relationships with investors? And how do you think about how transparent you can be?
The principle that at the beginning of COVID that I took on, which doesn't always come naturally to me, is to really over-communicate with our shareholders. So we were speaking at board level monthly, whereas before we would speak three times a year. In terms of building good relationships and being honest, I mean, there wasn't a lot of option. In the scenario, in the business that we were in, you can't really paint a rosy picture. The natural inclination for me has always been to talk about things that are positive, but also talk about the things that we've learned along the way. Investors, especially at early stage startups, they're there for the journey as well. Good investors know that you've got things to learn and that you're going to make mistakes along the way, and that all of this is going to compile to help you to build an amazing business that they've invested in. But one of the most important things that they look out for, and I think for developing as a leader, is really knowing when you can identify what's gone wrong, why it hasn't worked, where it's your mistake, and what you can do better next time. So with COVID, I was just very open about the variety of options that we'd assessed and which one we were going to do and why. We've, for the most part, have maintained a positive future outlook. It's just been very delayed. Keeps getting delayed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. How have you managed to reinvent the business in a time when events are illegal or not happening?
We made a decision earlier on in the lockdown, which was, do we pivot to do something else? Or do we believe that real events and people getting together in person will come back? It'll just be a matter of time and we need to hold tight. And we decided to maintain our mission and our core business model and believe that people will want to get back together in person, potentially in slightly different ways, and actually, you know, create new opportunities for us on team offsites and team away days. So we focused our efforts on preparing ourselves for that market shift and being able to support there. We have introduced virtual events. So our core mission is about connecting people in spaces, but we have shifted that to help our event organizers to connect with their teams or with their friends via virtual offerings. So that's been great. And we've got some brilliant new partners like Sofar Sounds, who are a live music business that I love. They bring early stage musicians and gigs to your home.
Is that Sofar Sounds?
Yeah.
I actually met the CEO at one of your events. I remember now.
Oh,
yeah.
So that's good. And some of our venues have virtual offerings, so we can support them in helping them to drive revenue from whether it's like cocktail making or cooking classes. So that's a kind of new arm of the business that we've been working on.
Well, I'm going to go on record and say I think it's a safe assumption that people will want to meet up in person again. And actually, even if we do move towards some more remote working society, I think that would only increase the need for external venues for people to meet up in person. And
yeah,
kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about the importance of building trust and making connections. For sure, one of the topics that's been coming up a lot in my sessions with clients is over time, trust seems to decay unless you actively rebuild it. And that in-person element is a really important part.
I totally agree. I did a lot of customer research last year around what are the things that people really need to do in person that virtual is a poor, poor substitute for, versus when is it an okay substitute? And the concept that I got to was brainstorm and beers, which is that the two things that people can't do very well or don't like to do virtually is to, when you really need to brainstorm something or have a creative discussion around something, it's not defined and fixed. It needs team input, and then really just having fun together and, you know, going out and having some drinks and connecting on a personal level. I think we can all agree that Zoom quizzes and drinks have run their course.
Oh my God, absolutely. But what an interesting insight around the brainstorming piece. There's probably lots of reasons for that. I imagine just having a little bit of latency on a Zoom call, that little almost imperceptible gap, actually kind of stunts the ability to build off people. And in a brainstorm, you're kind of speaking over each other, which in person is slightly easier to do than when you're on a Zoom call.
That great stat around 7% of your communication is what you say.
Yeah.
Over 40% is body language, with the remainder being your tonality and how you say it.
Gotcha.
Of course, the tonality part comes through on Zoom, but it's very hard to read body language virtually. And I think if you're having big problem solving brainstorms and discussions where, you know, there's heat in the room and you're getting the debate that you want, it's really hard to channel that virtually in the same way as you can in person, where you're not quite sure if people are being offended by things or happy to challenge each other or.
Yeah. You mentioned you're waiting to get back to your core business. What are your thoughts on that waiting process?
We've got ourselves into a position that as long as at some point in 2021 it comes back, that we shouldn't have to make too many changes to the business from where we are, from a people perspective. But, you know, it's very, very hard to judge. I'm hopeful that we'll start to, you know, come out of this April, May time. I think the thing that will be really interesting for us to see is that I'm hopeful that, like you said, that on the consumer confidence side, that people do want to get back together in person. And I think it's going to be very important for people like us as a business to put at ease people's fears as to why it might not be safe to do so, really working with venues to make sure that if people are getting together, that the right kind of measures are in place whilst the virus still exists. We're diversifying by looking at international markets a bit differently now and thinking of ourselves more globally, and we'll be ready to ramp up in different cities outside the UK if that feels like the right thing to do and they're recovering at a different rate. But yeah, it's the boring job of cash flow management is really the my like core role. The first like 2 years of the tech business, I barely knew what cash flow was.
Yeah.
I'm joking, shouldn't have meant to that. But you care about revenue. That's what you're trying to grow your core metrics, but it's all about cash.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm so glad to have you on the pod finally. I hope this time next year you come back on with a different story. Hopefully this year will be everyone's comeback year.
Fingers crossed.
What was it like to come on the pod?
It was great. Thank you for having me. And so early in the morning.
Very early in the morning. I really appreciate you being so honest and transparent. And I look forward to the big comeback for all of us, but and particularly for VenueScanner. Thanks to all the listeners. I hope you got something valuable from this episode. Come back next time where we will be speaking with another brave CEO who's willing to bear all and show us what it's really like. Please go ahead and hit subscribe if you want to hear that next episode. You can do that in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or wherever you listen. And I'll catch you soon.